Really, the best way that I can sum this one up would be to say Peter Weller punches Meg Foster in the face.
Radio Drone. It is 1989, and I know there is some monster under the sea that is going to kill Josh Hadley. That is I. Welcome to Radio Drone. With me, as always, is Cecil T. Robot.
Yes.
Way to follow up. And
you want gold out of me, like right out of the gate. I got nothing.
Peter, you got something?
Well, 1989 would be 25 years or so before I had an ulcer, so I would definitely love to be 2 years old again.
I was 14, so you know what won't give you an ulcer, Peter?
What's that?
AdamandEve.com. If you go there, you use the promo code DROME, and you get, what do they get, Cecil?
Great. Me again? God damn it.
I'm doing that to screw with you.
You get 3 free DVDs.
6 free DVDs.
6 free DVDs. That's right. It's double the DVDs. A free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, free U.S. shipping, all for using the promo code DROME at AdamandEve.com. Yada, yada, yada.
I set your ass up good, boy.
Yes. Stay away from my ass.
We'll see. The reason I'm saying it's 1989 is we're going to look at how 1989 had this weird obsession with undersea monsters. No less than 6 undersea monster movies were produced in 1989. One of them didn't technically come out till 1990, but I'm giving it a pass because it was made in 89. After Alien, all of the studios had their Alien ripoff. After Star Wars, they all had their Star Wars ripoff. After Jaws, their Jaws ripoff, etc., etc. What do you think about 1989? Had everyone saying, you know what, space is over, let's go to the other unexplored danger zone, but this time on Earth, underwater. Now, we knew James Cameron was making The Abyss, but because that had a bigger budget than everything else and a much longer production slate, do you think that all of this was to ride the wake of what they were assuming would be the monster hit, The Abyss? Or do you think it was just something, no pun intended, in the water in 89 that everybody wanted an underwater monster movie?
I think it was both in anticipation for it and possibly coincidence as well, because it's not necessarily an original idea. I mean, movies of, you know, deep sea exploration and encountering giant monsters had happened before. So some of those movies, I think, were just made as kind of an update on that genre from like what's the one, the something Leagues Under the Sea? I think that was in like the 50s or 40s or something that came out.
Just because a movie's old doesn't make it ancient, Peter.
Oh, shut up. But I could see it. Some of the movies that would be coming out in the later 80s would maybe sort of be an update on that genre. But then there are, I do think that it, some of them were in anticipation for Abyss, though, because you have a movie like Deep Star 6, for example. You have it's specifically some kind of alien under the sea. Leviathan was sort of that thing as well. So I think it really could go either way, because it could be coincidence as well, because hell, the whole underwater alien thing goes back as far as H.P. Lovecraft, so you never really know.
Why was 1989 the linchpin year for this kind of movie?
I've talked about this a bunch of times on various videos. Hollywood loves trends, so when something comes along and they think that it's going to be the next big thing, studios all jump on board. I mean, there was the natural disaster movies in the 70s, then again in the 90s with like Volcano and Twister and all that. And in the late 80s, after James Cameron was blowing up, they got wind that he was doing an underwater movie. He was doing The Abyss. So a bunch of other studios were like, you know, well, we have to get our undersea movie out before this big undersea movie. Try to, you know, ride off of that hype train. I mean, a lot of times it's a good thing, because there are, it's not like they just see that there is an underwater movie and they write it and get it into theaters. You know, it's these are scripts that they've had sitting around.
No, not necessarily. When we get to Roger Corman's, it was okay, literally, but I want to beat the abyss in theaters. This comes out in 3 weeks.
And that's Corman, though. That's what he does with everything. I'm talking like, you know, the non-Corman productions, you know, the Leviathans, the deep Star Sixes. They're ones that, you know, they were just kind of, you know, happened to be the right place, the right time, where it was like, all right, well, we've got these scripts. Let's make these movies. And so they got them. And they kind of didn't rush them into production. It's just that The Abyss was such a huge movie and ended up, I mean, that whole, did you ever watch any of the behind the scenes stuff on that?
Oh yeah.
Man, what a nightmare shoot that was. Okay.
That was one of these that was actually shot underwater. Mm-hmm. Deep Star 6, Leviathan, Endless Descent, and The Evil Below, and Lords of the Deep were all shot essentially dry for wet, so they faked it. Cameron was actually shooting underwater, so that makes a big difference in shooting time.
And it's funny, too, because really, for all the work that they put into it, I mean, The Abyss is a beautiful-looking movie, but the underwater scenes don't look that much more believable for all the effort and trouble that they put into it. You could watch Leviathan and then watch The Abyss. Aside from like the bubbles, there really isn't a major difference.
So let's start at the beginning of this trend. Now, keep in mind that this is all in anticipation of The Abyss, which is the biggest budget and most high profile of all these. Some of the other companies, such as Carolco, you know, they love to spend money on trends. Carolco rushed out, and yes, it was a rush job, Sean S. Cunningham's Deep Star 6 at the very beginning of 1989, January 13th, 1989, Deep Star 6 comes out. With an $8 million budget, technically making its budget back at the box office, it made $8,143,225 theatrically. So when you count distribution and print costs, it did not make its budget back. Being distributed by TriStar Pictures, Deep Star 6 came out and basically no one noticed. My problem with Deep Star 6 is it's just not that good of a movie. Honestly, I was surprised it had an $8 million budget because the movie feels cheap to me. The sets look cheap. The set design is cheap. Most of the cast are waning TV actors. I mean, seriously, of the 9 main cast members, 7 of them had just recently canceled TV shows. So you've got a mainly TV cast, cheap sets, a monster you don't want to show, and Sean Cunningham, let's face it, guys, he's not the most innovative director that there is out there. Deep Star 6 did not work for me.
I like Deep Star 6 a lot. I actually had a chat with Sean S. Cunningham a while ago about it, and it's one of his movies that he likes. Like, he really enjoys that movie, and he wishes that it was more popular. You know, he's happy that he gets a lot of credit for Friday the 13th, as he should, but Deep Star 6 is one of those movies that, like, it's always overlooked, and I think it's a shame. I mean, yes, it does have a lot of TV actors in it, but George Clooney was a TV actor. And I'm not putting them on par with that, but I'm saying being an ex-TV actor doesn't automatically make you a bad actor.
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of one of the My Two Dads being our hero doesn't exactly make me root for him, you know?
I thought he was good.
He was good. He's a good-looking guy. And he, you know, I mean, why? He looked like somebody who would have, you know, been an 80s hero.
Yeah, he had a bit of a Jack Burton vibe to him, I thought.
I thought the only actor I loved in this was Miguel Ferrar, but he is such a dirtbag that I can't like his character.
Well, Miguel Ferrar is always great. But I mean, the My Two Dads guy, who his name's eluding me, I thought he was good. Greg Avian, yes. Miguel Ferrar is great. I like Nia Peebles. I thought, you know, she's always pretty.
She was barely in the movie. She's like the second one killed.
But, you know, she's good. It doesn't matter. But I like it. I don't think it looked cheap. I thought the monster looked cool. I actually, you know, I wish they would have been able to show it a little bit more. But, you know, budget constraints and whatnot. Overall, I like it. I don't see it as being a bad movie at all.
I dig it. It's not my favorite of the movies that came out to kind of capitalize on Abyss, whether coincidence or not. But I do like it. I pretty much agree with everything Cecil said. I don't think it's a cheap looking movie. I think the monster, and it actually does look pretty cool. It's almost like it kind of reminded me of like a really jacked Predator. Like it had like just much bigger versions of everything. It had a cool color palette to it. Even though the characters in it are TV actors, they all did a really good job. I like the main guy, Miguel Ferrer, really made for a great scumbag. Like wanted to see him.
Miguel Ferrer stole the movie from the rest of the cast.
Yeah, he had easily the best death in the whole movie too. The escape pod.
Watched that when Miguel Ferrer dies from the explosive decompression. That was obviously a lot gorier.
Yeah.
Because you can see the abrupt, almost smash cuts away from gore in that, which really wrecks the pacing of the scene when they're obviously trying to not show something.
Yeah, I think we were definitely supposed to see like a rib cage or a head explosion or something. But either way, it was still really gruesome. Like, you know, his veins popping out in his wrists and like the blood seeping out of his eyes and his ears and shit. A nice gruesome way for such a dickbag to go. But overall, yeah, I really like it. It didn't feel cheap. I liked the miniatures. I thought it did a good job of looking like it was underwater. It had a nice straightforward plot to it. And I thought it was paced well. I thought they did a good build up for the creature. I really like Harry Manfredini's score. Again, you know, working with Sean S. Cunningham of the whole Friday the 13th fame. And I even kind of spotted that, and I'm pretty sure Sean Cunningham had to do with this, that the ending is very reminiscent of the first Friday the 13th, where you have the monster jumping out at the water while they're in the life raft, which I thought was a nice nod, whether intentional or not. It reminded me of Friday the 13th.
One of the problems I had with Deep Star 6 was the fact that the monster doesn't do much. Yes, the monster is the reason everything is happening, but of the 9 main cast members, the monster only kills 4 of them, and one of them is debatable. He kills the 2 guys in the underwater cat, he kills the guy he bites in half, and he kind of maybe kills Nia Peoples. It's kind of vague whether she kind of commits suicide to avoid being killed by it. Cindy Pickens kills herself. Miguel Ferrer kills himself to avoid the monster. Miguel Ferrer accidentally kills the doctor. So it's like the monster is kind of ineffectual in the whole movie.
Miguel Ferrer accidentally kills himself.
Well, yeah, he knew what was going to happen. The doctor was screaming at him. And remember, he hit the button and went, fuck it. And just
idiot. Kind of played up as a bit of a dumbass, like just not thinking about it, like just the way he killed the doctor with that blowgun, which again is a nice little gruesome part in the movie, the way they did that. I wasn't really just watching it again. I wasn't expecting to see that much violence. But I think with his death, it really is just the guy was just negligent throughout the whole thing. It was him that caused the the warheads or whatever to go off because of his choice of commands. So I think that was just a guy doomed by his own just dumbassery.
Now, since Deep Star 6 didn't really make a lot of money, I don't know what they were thinking about the next film that came out, which would be Leviathan, which I think is the most fun of all of these. I'll go on record now as saying I think The Abyss is obviously the most well-made of all of these, but Leviathan is my favorite. I loved Leviathan. I saw this one in the theater. It had a $20 million budget. It was put out by MGM, and no one came again. This one only made $15 of its $20 million budget. I'm not going to go too deep into the background on this because you should just go and watch Cecil's Good Bad Flicks Exploring Leviathan for some great background on this. But this one, the story by David Peoples is essentially, what if Alien and The Thing were set underwater? And that's not necessarily a bad thing because David Peoples is usually, I'd say, quote, a better writer than this, but he gave an interview to Fangoria back when this came out, and he said he gave the studio what they wanted. They told him, we want Alien underwater. So I don't think he had a lot of freedom to make it, I guess, more unique than it was because he gave the studio what they were paying him for. But you've got a cast of Peter Weller, Richard Crenna, Amanda Pays, Daniel Stern, Ernie Hudson, Michael Carmine, Lisa Eilbacher, Hector Elizondo, and Meg Foster. It's like, that's a fantastic cast. I don't care what Amanda Pays plays. She is always Theora Jones to me. She's Theora Jones. I don't care that her character is Elizabeth Williams. She's Theora Jones underwater. That's just something with Amanda Pays. But Leviathan is a fantastic movie. It's got great gore effects, great direction. It's got a good script for what it is. It's got a lot of little nuances and touches. Leviathan, I think, is the best of all of these just for pure enjoyment.
Agreed. It is the best one. It is my favorite. It's incredibly well-paced. The characters are really cool. Everybody feels fleshed out. You feel like you really get to know everybody. Scary as all f**k, just because it has that vibe of The Thing. It is like a mix of Alien and The Thing just underwater. This thing absorbs the characters, like their faces show up on its body, and it's just really disturbing looking. The cast just knocks it out of the park. But I think really you said it all. The best way that I can sum this one up would be to say Peter Weller punches Meg Foster in the face.
In today's social climate, I don't think you could do that. Her character Her character totally deserved it. But I don't think in today's social environment, you could not have Peter Weller just decking her the way he does.
That would immediately be misogyny, violence against women. But Meg Foster is an evil corporate bitch. She's the Dick Jones of the movie. And she totally deserves to get slugged in the face by RoboCop.
The Abyss is the better movie, but Leviathan is the one that I always come back to. I enjoy it more. It is Alien underwater mixed with elements of The Thing, but it's still just a fun, kick-ass movie. There's so much going for it. The great cast, the score, the whole thing just breezes by. It's not slow, but they still spend enough time with character development. Like, they really don't get into the whole monster element of it for quite a while. They kind of let the characters build, and you kind of get to know them and whatnot. And even when Sixpack, drinks the vodka and gets the virus, even then they're still kind of giving you time to get to know the characters. So when, the shit finally hits the fan, it doesn't feel rushed, but it doesn't feel like it took forever to get there either, which is really hard to do, because I know a lot of people will bitch and complain.
I have a feeling that is due to David Peoples. You got to remember, David Peoples, this is the writer of 12 Monkeys and Blade Runner and Soldier and other movies like that. David Peoples is a good writer. So even though he seemed a little hamstrung by we want an Alien underwater, I think he put as much quality into it as he possibly could.
Yeah, I think he really made his own movie. Like, as Cecil said, it does have a vibe of Alien in The Thing. With the characters, the atmosphere, just everything really felt like its own thing, even though it was a capitalized on the Abyss kind of film and it was meant to be Alien underwater. He really ran with it and made it his own thing. And I think that also makes Leviathan stand out as one of the better ones.
Another one of the reasons that it kind of feels alien-esque and maybe a little more of like an actual used future, in quotes, is that the production designer was Ron Cobb.
Yeah, the corridors are definitely reminiscent of like the Nostromo.
Even just like the lived-in crew quarters and everything, they look like the Nostromo, in all honesty. And the reason I put future in quotes is they never tell us when this movie takes place, but the technology obviously makes it into the future. They're still using VHS tapes, and they're still using backlit green screen monitors on their computers and whatnot. So it's kind of like, this is like a lo-fi future.
Yeah, it's even kind of like the future in the Alien. Like in Alien, it's a very lo-fi kind of future. It's obviously meant to be taking place, hundreds of years or whatever in the future where we have starships. But yeah, you still have like very cheap looking computers and tapes and whatnot. So it's kind of bizarre and cool.
Actually, Alien going from 2015, actually Alien only takes place about 65 years in the future. But you gotta remember, that was also made 30 years ago, so would have been about 95 years in the future from when it was made.
On the Blu-ray for Leviathan, they were talking, some of the special effects guys, the Stan Winston group, they were talking about how they had 60 different designs for the monster. And they took it to the director, and they were like, what do you like, what don't you like? And he liked
all of them!
All of them. So I just love the, okay, Jort. And they threw everything into the monster. So it, you know, it had like, you know, the faces of the crew, arms, hair, teeth, scales, Elbacher's boob is hanging off the side of it somewhere. I mean, it's like they put every single thing they could into it. It's hilarious because it's like, all right, well, this is just this genetic mess.
Wow, 1989, though, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, since I was just watching this last night, there's a nice, wow, that's an 89 reference in the movie, too. When they're going through the pilferage from the Leviathan, at one point, Amanda Pays goes, she pulls out a watch, and she goes, a Timex, and it's still ticking.
Oh.
Like, oh, my God, that's such a late 80s reference.
Yeah, I always was, I like the Kitty Does Kiev thing.
It's not really Kitty Does Kiev.
It's such a like just well made, just entertaining movie. Freaking Peter Weller is great. Amanda Pays is like, and like, oh, the other thing with the end too, where she, Meg Foster, not only left them down there to die, but basically told everyone on the surface that they were already dead, so that they wouldn't even attempt to rescue them.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's evil. She should be lucky that, like, if that was the typical sci-fi movie, like, evil corporate white guy, the monster would have eaten him, or she would, or he would have gotten shot with a rocket or something. Like, he would have had a much worse fate. But because it was, you know, just a woman, she got a, you know, a punch to the face, even though, like, what she did was, she deserved more for being that horrendously evil.
Well, no.
She deserved more, but there's just something so satisfying about just Peter Weller punching someone in the face.
Just that crack. You know? Oh, you made it, crack. You know,
he just has that steely.
In a way, it's a sucker punch.
Oh yeah.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this. I saw them setting up a sequel because there's a specific shot after we know that Bowman is infected, but she's not showing symptoms yet. They get done with their last day of mining, and her and Peter Weller share a drink from the same bottle of water, and they do a close-up of him drinking it. And then, remember, she's infected. And then later on, when he saws the monster's arm off, when Ernie Hudson is holding the door open, this creature scratches him, which is also what infected Hector Elizondo's character.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I read into it that Beck was infected when he made it to the surface. He just isn't showing symptoms yet. So it almost seems like they were kind of subtly setting up a sequel, or that was just miscellaneous crap and I'm seeing what's not there.
Maybe they were trying to do like a dark ending where you kind of go, oh, well, it's not quite as happy as things seem. But I really would have liked the sequel. I really liked the just the creature design and the way the thing was in the movie. It was very original for what it was. So it would have been cool to see a Leviathan too. It's too bad we didn't get that.
Well, the reason we didn't get that is absolutely no one went to see this in the theater.
Oh,
it
man.
Lost a ton of money, not just the $5 million, because when you got to take in everything else, it lost a lot of money. So MGM basically wrote the movie off. And then we had, a month later, Roger Corman's entry into this, Lords of the Deep, starring Priscilla Barnes and Bradford Dillman. This one is so much fun for all the wrong reasons. I can't find any budget information. If this thing has more than $100,000 budget, I will be legitimately shocked. The sets look like sets from the 70s TV show Space 1999. Costumes look like something out of Rocky Jones' Space Ranger. The effects, Bradford Dillman is the evil corporate scumbag, and his office in the undersea base is clearly an office. He's got like Venetian blinds that light is coming through underwater. This thing is so low budget, and it's so brutally miscast. Priscilla Barnes is a fine actress, but with her nice persona and her little cupy voice, I do not take her as this Ripley-type character that she's meant to be. She's just so miscast. The movie, it's only an hour and 14 minutes with credits, full opening credits and full closing credits. So that brings the runtime down to maybe an hour 9. And then maybe another 15 minutes of footage from Galaxy of Terror and Battle Beyond the Stars is inserted at various points. I don't even know if this is an actual movie. It's so fun, but I cannot say Lords of the Deep is a good movie. Did either of you guys see Lords of the Deep?
Unfortunately not.
I saw it a long time ago, so I really don't remember much of it.
I watched it last night, and I had forgotten just how cheap, both in budget and in tone, this thing felt. Now we get to the one that none of us have seen. The Italians, of course, had to throw their hat into this ring with The Evil Below, which, since none of us have seen it, I'm going to sum it up. An American with the most Italians think this is how Americans' names really are, Max Cash, is a down-on-his-luck fisherman who has to go and try and remove treasure from a sunken barge in the Bahamas that is haunted by ghosts who control a sea monster. It sounds glorious.
It does. I was looking at that one on IMDb, but I wasn't able to find a copy to watch.
I unfortunately found out about that one too late. But yeah, that one just, it looks and sounds just everything that a little Italian exploitation should be.
Yeah. All I can say is roll fizzle beef, deep sea diver.
Max Cash.
Stump Junkman of the sea.
Was it?
Chest big, McLarge big, huge.
Yes, Big McLarge huge.
Big McLarge huge.
So, well, then after that, we get to the one that everyone was anticipating, James Cameron's The Abyss, which I'm of two minds on this one. I saw it in the theater in 89, and I hated it. I saw it again on video in 90, and I hated it. The theatrical cut of The Abyss is a goddamn mess. It's a terrible film. On the other hand, I think the director's cut, adding 28 minutes back into the film can really change a movie, is a fantastic movie. So when I say I like and hate The Abyss, that's why. The theatrical cut, I do hate. The director's cut, I do love. The Abyss is the director's cut is a very well-paced movie. It's got great characters, great story. The characters act with motivation. One of the things the theatrical cut was full of was, why did that character do that? Oh, because there was a 5-minute scene that we cut out. None of the characters in the theatrical cut have a motivation for what they're doing. Now all of a sudden, Coffee has a motivation of why he's freaking out. Now all of a sudden, Midnight has a motivation for what she's doing. Now all of a sudden, we have a motivation for Bud and What's-Her-Face's relationship and all that. Cutting out all the motivations made a big deal in how... I don't care if it got the running time down by a half hour. It made the film terrible to me. And considering the film only made $20 million over its $70 million budget, the theatrical cut was not the blockbuster that Fox was hoping for. I think they should have just let Cameron have his director's cut straight up. But I think this is the most ecological. This is the most message of all of these movies. There's a clear pro-environment, anti-nuke, end the Cold War message in this thing. It's not pervasive until the end, and it doesn't feel like it's shoved down your throat. I think the director's cut of this movie is absolutely fantastic.
I saw the theatrical cut on home video when it first came out, and I liked it. I thought it was okay, but I had a lot of the problems that you had. I didn't like hate it like you did, but there wasn't as much motivation. There did seem to be a lot missing. Like, it did seem like things were progressing a little too quickly and characters were acting unusual out of nowhere. Then years later, when the special edition DVD came out that put that huge, the tidal wave subplot back.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you. Before that, all those subplots and all the scenes were put back in on the Sci-Fi Channel. Ran a special edition with the debut of all those scenes and the correct ending in widescreen. So all those scenes actually debuted on Sci-Fi before it came out on video or DVD with those.
Well, I picked up the DVD and I was very excited because I remember I saw it in a magazine. I don't remember which, one of those like special effects, Starlog or something, where they had a picture of the tidal wave and they were talking about this whole big chunk of the abyss that was missing. So I was really excited when it finally did come out and I picked it up. And yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought that it fleshed the movie out more. It gave a lot more character motivation. It did show a lot more. I mean, there's so many special effects that they had to cut, which I'm sure was not cheap. Made the movie more whole, made the ending make more sense. And
the ending didn't come as out of nowhere as it does in the theatrical cut. Because it's like the theatrical cut, you're moving along, moving along, moving along. And then the last 5 minutes are like out of a different movie almost.
Yeah. So it is definitely the better movie. And it is a genuinely good movie that deserves the praise that it gets. But I still like Leviathan better.
I'd seen the theatrical one and obviously not in theaters, but I do remember watching it. And I remember scratching my head and going, why the fuck is Michael Biehn going crazy for no reason? And then I saw the director's cut. And it's like, oh, well, OK, this movie is better than I remember it being. I do like it. I think it's a really well done movie. It has some great both practical and digital effects that really shows that James Cameron knows what he's doing when it comes to visual stuff. There's a nice some of the CG was a nice predecessor to what he would do in Terminator 2. I love the characters. I love seeing Michael Biehn as a bad guy in general is a kind of a treat because you don't get to see it too often. I think he does a good job of it. He has a good good crazy eyed look to him, and Ed Harris is always awesome. I respect it for what it is. I definitely agree that it deserves the praise that it gets. But as Cecil said, in my case, any day of the week, I would rather watch Leviathan. I just think that one has more of a fun premise. It moves along a little bit quicker, and I think the characters are just cooler. And I don't know, given the choice, I'm usually going to go toward Peter Weller.
I do think this one does have a great cast. There's only one scene that bothers me in the entirety of The Abyss, and that is the whole bringing What's-Her-Face back from the dead. Fight! You're a fighter! You don't quit on me! That is the most cliched. You know, it would not have been cliched if she had gone up and died then. That scene bothers me in every cut of the film. Other than that, I think the characters all act relatively logically. And I want to point out to today's new generation, Ed Harris is at the bottom of the ocean, at one of the deepest parts of the ocean, with fluid in his lungs and no light, and he's able to text full words and only make two typos. You can text full words, goddammit. The success of The Abyss. And like I said, after marketing and whatnot, it technically lost money, but it was overall a success. We go into the last one of these movies that came out, which would actually not come out until 1990, although my VHS says 1991 as a copyright, which would be The Rift / Endless Descent. Now, I haven't seen this one, but I've watched Cecil's video, so rather than me vamping through it, Cecil, do you want to explain to us The Rift / Endless Descent?
The Rift / Endless Descent is just, it's a really fun sci-fi horror movie. It starts off sci-fi and then it really turns into like horror towards the end. You've got a young Jack Scalia and Arlie Ermey, Ray Wise. They're all going in this experimental sub and they're investigating this rift that goes down like deeper into the ocean than they previously knew about. And then when they get
so deep that they don't need pressure suits to swim outside the sub because science is for pussies.
Well, no, because then they find that place where they can go up and then there's, you know, it's fully pressurized. So they go into the rift and they find this cave. And then when they're in there, they find the real reason they were sent down there is there is this government facility that's been doing all this genetic research, and there are these little freaky-ass monster tentacle things that come out and just start eating everyone.
Okay, and, I gotta ask this. Genetic research, does that ever not go bad? Have you ever seen a movie where genetic research has actually not turned into some horrific, you know, it's not come out as some horrific outcome?
Nope.
Yeah, genetic research always ends badly. You know, it's never like, you know, we went in and we were trying to make a better this and we made it and everything's better now. It's always
we were
like,
trying to make a soda additive and we accidentally cured cancer.
Right. It's no, we were trying to make a dog and merge it with a bear. And now it's mauling everyone. And oh, God, dog bear.
but then you got Lance Henriksen hunting it down with Endless Descent. Now, certain actors get typecast. Like off mic, the three of us were joking around earlier today about how Michael Biehn basically plays the same character in anything. And
yeah.
I pointed out, have you ever seen Seventh Sign, the Demi Moore movie where he plays her husband and he's a brain surgeon? You don't buy it for a second because it's Michael Biehn. I love the guy. Don't mistake this. But there are certain types of characters, like when he plays a FEMA a FEMA scientist in the miniseries Asteroid, you're like, no, not buying it. It's Michael Biehn. Yeah.
It's like, why isn't he shooting anybody?
Exactly. And in this, you got Ray Wise as the traitor. That's kind of like in Best of the Best, too. Why cast Meg Foster in that movie and not have her betray anybody? That's like having Ray Wise play a good guy. Oh, gee, Ray Wise betrayed them, Cecil. Didn't see that coming.
No, wasn't expecting that at all. But then going back and watching it again, like years and years later, I'm like, all right, well, there's Ray Wise. We all know who the traitor is.
Yeah, it becomes... not will he betray them, but at what point in the movie will he be revealed as the traitor?
Exactly, because they start off, they're like, we've got a mole. And I'm like, it's Ray Wise.
He's there. Of course it's Ray Wise.
Yeah.
But like at the beginning of Leviathan, when Meg Foster, you see it seems like she's not that bad of a character and really does have their best interests, like how she sells out the doctor to back in everything, kind of go, all right, maybe she's going to do the right thing. And then it's like, oh, wait, that's right. It's Meg Foster.
Yeah. Nope.
And you know what? Meg Foster is probably the sweetest person ever in real life. Now, all of these movies failed except for The Abyss. Why do you think 1989, and I'm lumping The Rift, Endless Descent in there just for clarity's sake. Why do you guys think that all of these movies came out in 1989, but only one of them actually worked? Because usually when you do these trends, more work than don't, and I'm talking as hits, only one of these six made money. So why do you think it was the audience in 1989 that was just sick of, we've got six of these coming out? But literally, that's one every 2 months on average. We've got an underwater monster movie coming out. Or was it just something about the movies like Leviathan and Deep Star 6 both have huge cult audiences today? They didn't back in 89. Is it the audience's fault or was it the market at the time's fault?
I'd say the market at the time, just because, I mean, come on, you're comparing, you got to compare the fact that Abyss was released by James Cameron and likely had a hell of a lot of people backing it. A much
20th
larger...
Century Fox.
Yeah, a much larger theatrical distribution. So I think that in itself would be why it made a hell of a lot more money than any of the other ones that came out. And also probably a bit of the audience, too, because it's like, OK, well, we've already seen The Abyss. Why the fuck do I have to go see this one? Oh, big deal. It's another people going under the water and being attacked by an alien thing. Bah, it's probably just it's the cynicism of the audience seeing kind of sensing that, oh, well, this is just a cash grab. I'm not going to see this. And they just ended up fucking themselves because Leviathan, because that movie deserved a hell of a lot more praise and deserved to make a hell of a lot more money. And I really would have liked to have seen a sequel. So fuck you, 1989 audience.
Do you think, though, that it might have something to do with the fact that The Abyss is a sci-fi movie that is relatively accessible to a general audience, whereas every single one of the other five are straight-up horror movies? Do you think that there was technically two different audiences between the other five and The Abyss? Do you think that played a factor in it, too?
No, I think really what it came down to was that The Abyss had a much larger marketing budget, and it was probably pushed really hard. And the mindset was probably something along the lines of, well, you know, the James Cameron movie's coming out this August. Why do I want to watch these crappy knockoff movies?
Because The Abyss was marketed as like a mystery underwater and a character piece. Deep Star 6 and Leviathan, for example, were marketed as horror movies. They were marketed towards the alien audience. I think The Abyss was marketed differently than the others, even though the same people who like Deep Star 6 are probably going to like The Abyss and vice versa. The marketing, the posters, the trailers were so on different sides of the aisle. I think that did create a separation there.
I think it was definitely the marketing. And but the thing that's funny, I mean, Alien was a huge success, you know, was a lot like Leviathan. Who knows? The crowds are fickle. Movies that you think are going to be monumental successes, just for whatever reason, they just don't land at the right time. They don't come out. The public's not really in the mood for. I mean, there any number of factors can go into, you know, why a movie is or is not successful.
Yeah, I think it did. Just with how Abyss was definitely a different kind of movie. It was more of like a mysterious thing. The aliens weren't necessarily like the kind of violent threat that the aliens were in the other movies.
Although I do want to say, if they had like started punching Ed Harris in the face and still like face raping him, that would have been awesome because they're so cute and they look like stuffed animals and stuff. If they turned out to be these violent little things, now that would have been a plot twist.
That would have been a hell of a twist for sure. But yeah, I think with movies like Deep Star 6 and with movies like Leviathan, they were really more geared in sort of that sci-fi horror genre film kind of style. They wanted to mimic kind of the alien presence along with or piggyback a bit on the forthcoming new James Cameron film that's sure to be a hit. And so in that case, I think maybe it sort of made that mistake because people were very amped up and excited to see this new sort of this mystery in dealing with aliens and underwater stuff and underwater exploration. And the other two coming out, it's like they kind of look at that and go, well, it's just alien in the water. Like, what do I care about that? Like, it's just people, I think, being kind of cynical and jaded and going, well, I've seen this before. It's just alien in the water. I'm just going to go and see, you know, the abyss. So I do think it was marketed in kind of that in kind of a way where they figure it would have been a bet because, hey, you know, Alien did well and I'm sure people are going to see The Abyss. So let's combine these. And then it kind of backfired because I think audiences just went, well, we've seen this before. It's just in a kind of a different setting.
Going from looking back at 1989 that we all are saying, like, I mean, I didn't enjoy Deep Star 6 as much as you guys did, but Deep Star 6, Leviathan, Endless Descent, Lords of the Deep and whatnot. Do you think that people appreciate these movies more now than they did then? Do you think it is kind of a movie like Leviathan was always destined to be a cult film?
No, I think like I could see Deep Star 6 being more of a cult film, but Leviathan, it really does have all the elements of what should have been a hit. You've got, you know, top tier special effects. You've got a great cast. You've got a great score. You've got a good director. I mean, it
Ernie Hudson's in Ghostbusters 2, which came out the same year. I don't know if they did this, but you could market it as Ernie Hudson from the Ghostbusters is in this.
And you had
Richard Grenna, I think, was doing either, was it Rambo 2 or Rambo 3?
It would have been Rambo 3 at that point.
Yeah. Peter Weller was about to do RoboCop 2, I think. So, yeah, it is kind of this cross promotion of all these actors that are also going to be in their own respective franchises.
Yeah, they could have done it with, you know, pulling the director in. They could have even done, you know, from the director of Rambo, First Blood Part 2, because Rambo was huge. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if they were to do that, you know, they would totally pull off of that because they love doing that now, you know, from the director of, from the producer of, and, you know, to get that name recognition there. All the elements of what should have been a hit and mm-hmm. just for whatever reason it wasn't. So I don't think it was destined. I think it was destined to be a hit. It just for whatever reason, it didn't happen right away. And now it's become a cult hit.
That said, do you think that these movies could be marketed with modern techniques today? If you were trying to sell this movie today, would a modern style trailer, say, fit Leviathan or Deep Star 6 or even The Abyss more, or were they just products of 1989?
I think you could market Leviathan and The Abyss, but the other ones are a little bit more time capsules.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I think that you know, both of them, you know, could be marketed today with using the, you know, today's kind of things. But especially with Leviathan, again, going back to the cast, because all of them, granted, they're not all as big a name as they were back then. But now a lot of people know who they are more. So you'd be like, oh, well, you've got Richard Crenna, you got Peter Weller, you got Ernie Hudson, and that, oh my God, wow, you know, all these guys in one movie. And then they would push, like I said, with the director of Rambo. And I think there's a possibility that it would probably do better now, but more than likely what they're going to do, I'm surprised they haven't announced a remake yet, quite frankly.
I don't know if you've seen this one, Peter, but I know Cecil and I've talked about it. Anyone that watches the pilot episode of the TV series Odyssey 5, there's a great joke in that. Right before the Earth explodes, the last signal that Peter Weller gets as the shuttle captain is Leviathan. Diesel, you know that had to be an in-joke that, that Manny Coto snuck into that.
Absolutely.
That kind of shows that the legacy that even something of a, quote, failure like Leviathan had. That's the only one of the failures of 89 that is still fondly remembered. You don't see people making Deep Star 6 references on current TV shows. You don't see Lords of the Deep references. You still see Abyss and Leviathan references, though. I just think 1989, it's just weird that you had six of these in one year. Because even when you got the trends, like, you know, you've got the double asteroid movies and you've got the double volcano movies and whatnot, you usually only have one or two, maybe three that are all similar. To have six in one year, I actually think that's relatively unique.
It is.
I think the people who were not alive in 89, like I said, I was 14, so I was totally cognizant of the marketing and whatnot, and I was reading about these in Fangoria and all this, and I don't know if you'd ever have that kind of a whirlwind of weird underwater monster marketing again. What are your final thoughts on the underwater monster movies of 89?
I think they're all really worth watching, at least the ones that I've seen. I still need to see Lords of the Deep. But I think when it comes to like movies like Endless Descent, a.k.a. The Rift, Leviathan, Deep Star 6, Abyss, they're all really cool in their own ways. And I think it's a really interesting time capsule of a year where, I mean there's always a trend in movies. And there is usually a year where a bunch of the same types of movies will come out, like the saving the president from terrorist trend in 2013, which I swear that was in my mind, at least it felt like it was a build up to a Bad Dudes movie starring Gerard Butler and Channing Tatum. But
I actually thought that the Gerard Butler movie was a discarded script for Under Siege 3. You tell me you couldn't have totally seen Seagal in that role if it had been made in, say, 96.
Would have worked as that, or even as a Die Hard plot. I think it had a really good like late 80s to early 90s action vibe to it. They're really awesome movies. I specifically recommend Leviathan because I think that's just a kick-ass movie with a heap of rewatch value. But it's really interesting. I don't think we'll quite see that again. Other than, I mean, I'm sure every year you have a movie that comes out that's popular. And then the Asylum will make its knockoff. I mean, that's been making its rounds for years, and it's a perfectly average thing at this point. But I don't really quite think we're going to see another. I mean, I'd love to see this again because it's really cool to see all these different takes on a similar plot. To have six of them come out, and possibly even more. That for all we know, there's other ones. But I think that's really interesting, and I would really like to see that again. With really any given genre, would be it action or sci-fi or horror, because it's really cool to have that variety. And I think movies kind of make their rounds as cult favorites due to that, because there's so many, and so many of them go on to have different fan bases. Like Deep Star 6 may not have the following that a movie like Leviathan has, but it's a total niche movie. It's a total cult film in its own right. You know, fans of Sean S. Cunningham and Friday the 13th are more sort of into that. So it's ingrained more into the sort of low budget horror world. And it's cool that it has that following. So I would really love to see that happen again. It's unfortunate that doesn't happen as often, because we usually just get, you know, Asylum making its knockoffs, and then you have the one big blockbuster movie, and I don't know, that kind of sucks. It feels like we're not getting as much as we used to.
Kind of piggybacking off what Peter said, it's now we're getting a slight variation on that. We're getting the monumental budget movie, and then we're getting the medium budget movie, and then we're getting the Asylum knockoff. So whereas in 89, with all these undersea movies, we had the big movie, but then you had a nice variety of different things. You know, Leviathan and Deep Star 6 were both, you know, decent sized budgets. The Endless Descent had a good budget. And then Lords of the Deep was kind of the low budget thing. And then the other one, we don't know, because we need to see Big McLarge Huge underwater. But
Cash!
But even still, probably had a low budget. But even still, we had this wide variety of different takes on a similar subject, where now we'll get, if we're lucky, we'll get three. sometimes we might get like, but I mean, and usually the Asylum one is the one that you watch for laughs.
I think it was kind of a golden lost age of exploitation, because nowadays you would not have Leviathan or Deep Star 6 with the kind of budgets that they had or being released wide in theaters. They would be Asylum films, or at best, they would be the relative higher end direct to video. These movies would not be theatrical anymore. And I think that's something that's a kind of a different topic of what changed in movie going. I think if you weren't around in 89, you should watch all of these movies in the order that they came out to kind of relive what being a sci-fi movie goer was like in 89. Cecil, if people want to plunge to the depths for you, where would they go?
They can go to escapistmagazine.com.
You remember the whole Addy this week, huh?
I know. You think I've only been there a month now. You think I would have known month and a half now.
But now you can't remember when you started. Great.
Well, it was the end of April. That was why I'm like, well, it was officially. So, all right. I've been there for a few months. escapistmagazine.com, as well as goodbadflix.com and geekjuicemedia.com.
Peter doesn't trust his rebreather. Can't trust anything without bubbles. Where would people see him doing that?
You can see me doing that on Twitter at Cinematica, Facebook, The Cinematicus, YouTube, The Cinematicus, and 1201beyond.com. But no, not the bubbles thing, the punching Meg Foster thing. I like that.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com, and you can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And then there's also a Patreon. I know how it's actually pronounced. I have more fun saying Patreon. It sounds like a Decepticon that way.
Yeah.
So there is a Patreon/Patreon for Radiodrome if you go and look that up. Also, I am now a columnist for Fangoria Magazine with the column VHS that you can find every month in Fangoria Magazine starting this month. Go and buy a Fangoria, damn it.
Speaking more. Radio Drone is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.